We've all been there. You're at a restaurant, you've finished your meal, and you really want to pay your check and leave, but the waiter is nowhere to be found. Well, a new service allows you to speed things up by text. From member station WBUR, Jessica Alpert reports.
It's a Thursday night when I walk into Charlie's Kitchen, a dive bar and cafe in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Charlie's is one of the first restaurants in the country to try Text My Food, a new service that allows you to communicate with your server via text. I slip into a corner booth and see a sticker on the wall. Can't find your server? Just text.
I'm at table 3. I want a tossed salad with ranch dressing. That's a lot of typing. Send.
In less than 5 minutes, my meal has arrived. Charlie's server, Christina Henry, watches me navigate the system.
You know, there's pros and cons to it. You know, it's great for like a night, like Friday night when we're really busy. It's packed and you're running around. People text like, can I have my check, please?
While Christina acknowledges that Text My Food may make her job easier, she finds the service impersonal.
As a server, I'd rather go to the guest and talk to them face to face and ask them what they would like instead of getting it through a computer.
When I visit Bob Nilsson, the president of Text My Food, he makes it clear that the service doesn't actually replace the server.
It's not eliminating human contact. There's always a server at the other end. You just want to have that contact sooner. You want to, if you can't see them and can't make that contact, rather than waving your arms or getting up, just use the natural communication and let them know what you need.
Nilsson explains that the goal of the service is to increase the amount a guest will spend. For example, guests are more likely to order another round of drinks if they text the request in the moment. If they can't find the server, they often pass. Back in the dining room, customer Zach Brickett is not impressed.
I guess it seems kind of pointless because I can tell my waitress to her face what I want to drink, so.
But John McSweeney has a different view. While he calls the system interesting,
I wondered that there's going to be a lot of abuse of this kind of thing. It sort of occurred to me to maybe just as soon as we ordered our beers, take out my phone and be like, beer, stat, now.
I've gotten glasses are sexy. I've gotten two of us need something. And three of us need your number.
That's Charlie's server, Joshua DeCosta. Prank texting is a problem. In response, some heavy drinking establishments turn off the service after a certain hour. But other managers say they appreciate the ability to monitor guests. If too many inappropriate texts come in from one person, it's time to cut them off. So I'm sitting with my check and credit card ready to pay. It's been a while, so instead of waving, I decide to send a little text.
Okay, T3. My credit card is waiting. Send.
A few seconds later, the server comes over, produces a smile, grabs my credit card, and heads back into the kitchen. We've barely exchanged a word, but I find texting extremely alluring. I message, she arrives. But don't worry, I left her an in-person tip. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Alpert.
All Things Considered continues right after this.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. This month marks the 50th anniversary of the inauguration of President John F. Kennedy. If the event seems like ancient history to some, the Kennedy Library and the National Archives hope to make it a bit more accessible. Today they announced that they've put all of the 35th president's important speeches, papers, and recordings online. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Go to www.jfklibrary.org and you can find the famous, like the president's inaugural address from January 20th, 1961.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
And there's the less well-known. Here's part of a 1962 TV and radio address on the admission of the first African-American to the University of Mississippi.
Mr. James Meredith, is now in residence on the campus of the University of Mississippi. This has been accomplished thus far without the use of National Guard or other troops.
The digital archive includes over 200,000 pages of speeches and notes, hundreds of reels of audio tape, and over 1,000 recorded phone conversations. JFK Library Director Thomas Putnam says putting it online was a long and painstaking process.
It's been a 4-year project. It's very labor-intensive because all of these documents and photos weren't born digitally, so each one needs to be hand-scanned.
The documents now online have been available at the brick-and-mortar JFK Library in Boston, but now anyone with access to a computer and the Internet can view firsthand drafts of Kennedy's inaugural, showing how the famous phrase, "Ask not what you can do for your country," evolved from "Ask not what your country is going to do." Putnam's favorite find?
I really do love the conversations he has during the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, nothing can bring you closer to that moment about what he was trying to deal with and hearing, you know, even the laughter and the conversation between him and Eisenhower.
Something may make these people shoot them off. I just don't believe this will.
Yeah, all right.
Well, in any event, of course, I'll say this. I'd want to keep my own people very alert.
Yeah. Well, hang on tight.
Yes, sir.
Thanks a lot, General.
All right.
All right.
At a reception announcing the opening of the online archive, Caroline Kennedy said her father's example, words, and spirit are more important than ever.
Using today's technology, we will be able to give today's generation access to the historical record and challenge them to answer my father's call to service, to solve the problems of our own time.
The president's daughter contributed to the archive. Her name is carefully printed in her then 5-year-old's handwriting on the back of one of Kennedy's papers. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
And as loans go out from China, money is flowing into China. It's coming from foreign companies trying to get a piece of the rapidly growing market in that country. Chinese officials said today that foreign direct investment into factories, real estate, and other businesses reached a record $105 billion last year, and that is up more than 17% from the previous year.
Here in the U.S., many small businesses can face limitations because they don't take credit cards. The fees and other costs associated with processing plastic is a turnoff for many of these small businesses, so they stick to cash. But new technologies are making it easier for even the taco truck guy or the local plumber to take on-the-spot credit card payments. Reporter Vanessa Romo reports.
Jeff Barber and Kurt Scheuer are standing at the top of the steep driveway looking out over a freshly mowed lawn in Old Agoura Hills in Southern California. Barber is holding an electric weed whacker, and Scheuer is holding his iPhone.
I'll go get the homeowner here.
Together, they own Hybrid Lawns, an environmentally friendly landscaping company. And using Scheuer's smartphone and a small gadget called Square, they're about to bill a client for a month's worth of work.
We got the $70 in here for your monthly payment,
all right.
And I'll take your card, and it's simple, just a quick swipe like that. There we go, it's authorizing now.
Scheuer and Barber started their business 2 years ago when the pair were laid off from their respective construction jobs.
And you've been approved.
Since then, they've been mowing lawns, pruning hedges, and scooping up leaves for about 20 clients. But Barber says, like a lot of small businesses, they've had trouble collecting regular payments.
We were trying to go paperless because we're eco-friendly, but for the most part, you know, we just emailed people. You know, email, here's your bill, you know, pay us your bill, send us a check, here comes the snail mail. Sometimes they kind of drag their heels a little bit.
They say getting paid can sometimes take weeks, which is why they got the Square device, a credit card reader about the size of a postage stamp that plugs into the headphone jack of either an iPhone, Android, or iPad. So now when they show up at the pretty yellow ranch house, Jackie Lacombe can't do what she usually does with a bill.
It sits there forever and I forget about it, so this makes it great because it's done. As soon as they, you know, come by with the bill, it's here, I'm finished.
We dramatically simplified the way people can start accepting payments so that you can accept them from anywhere.
Jack Dorsey is one of the founders of Square. If his name sounds familiar, it's because he's also the co-founder of Twitter. Dorsey says he was thinking about entrepreneurs like Scheuer and Barber when he came up with the idea for Square, on-the-go small or micro business owners. Square opened its doors to the public in October. the device and the software are free. The company takes a flat 2.75% of each transaction plus 15 cents, cheaper than fees charged by most other credit card payment systems.
And you have to pay up a bunch of these setup fees and monthly minimums and other fees that look a little bit odd. All you have to do with Square is download it, sign up. We give you a free reader, and you can start accepting card payments.
Square is now processing millions of dollars in mobile transactions every week. More than 45 million people in the U.S. have a smartphone. And as money exchanging portals, they're a fairly untapped market. Right now, there are only a few products. There's Intuit, another credit card swiping device made just for the iPhone. Also, a handful of banks let you deposit checks by taking pictures of them. And Chase allows person-to-person deposits via email. All of this virtual moving of money has people worried about fraud. John Herring of Lookout Mobile Security says that's why companies like Square have built in stringent security measures from the start.
They're using very strong encryption and a number of the best industry practices. Now it's going to be very important that anyone adopting a mobile payment technology make sure that they're taking steps to keep their mobile device itself safe.
In other words, treat your phone like your wallet. Don't leave it lying on a park bench. Herring says rather than fearing the future, think of it as extreme convenience with a little common sense security.
When we look at mobile payments in general, I think that it's really the future in terms of payments.
Smartphones are the fastest growing segment of the mobile phone market, which means mobile payments are growing as well. So the next time you're eyeing a brownie at a PTA bake sale with no money and no checkbook, you may want to ask if they take plastic. For NPR News, I'm Vanessa Romo.
The Detroit Auto Show opens to the public tomorrow, and there's a lot of buzz surrounding electricity. You name it, it's been electrified. An electric bicycle, electric moped, even a battery-powered racing car. Of course, there are plenty of electric cars. NPR's Sonari Glinton reports on how long it will take for all this electricity to come to you.
Here it is, the big news out of the North American International Auto Show in Detroit.
And the 2011 North American Car of the Year is the Chevrolet Volt.
The Chevy Volt, the electric car with a backup gas engine, is clearly the star of the Detroit Auto Show. But it's certainly not the only electric car or hybrid in the game.
Tesla, Nissan Leaf, Smart E, Mini E, Mercedes SLS E.
That's Jessica Caldwell. She's an analyst with Edmunds.com. It's an automotive website. She could keep listing the cars for a while, but here's the question. Are there enough electric cars in production so that if you wanted to buy one, you could get one right now?
You can't really get one. If you get one, it's going to be secondhand because there's such a high demand for those vehicles right now.
To give you an idea, December is one of the most important months for auto sales. And in December, General Motors sold 329 Chevy Volts. There are about 10 Nissan Leafs sold. Now, both those cars just started production, and neither of those companies are planning to keep the production at that level. Tony DeSale is head of marketing for the Chevy Volt.
Today, a lot of our customers are early tech adopters, typically the first on the block to have an iPhone or an iPad.
Or an electric car.
That's going to migrate through time. And so the most important thing is for consumers, mass market consumers, to understand the benefits of the Volt.
So in the coming years, what exactly is a mass market?
We've announced 10,000 units for sale during the 2011 calendar year.
And next year?
We'll sell 45,000 units or build 45,000 units for sale here in the United States.
To give you an idea of how many cars that is, Porsche sold 25,000 cars in the U.S. These are not tremendous numbers.
Look, the electrification of America's fleet is not going to occur overnight.
That is Bob Lutz. He just retired as vice chairman of General Motors. Lutz takes credit, often, for the Chevy Volt. He says electrification will be a gradual process.
And if you take yourself out to the year 2025 and you look at what percentage of the total vehicle market is going to be electric, it'll probably be 10 to 15%. But will it suddenly flip and like within 2 years you go into a showroom and half the cars are electric? The answer is no. That's going to take a long time.
Remember Jessica Caldwell, the analyst we heard at the top of the story? She says the plain old combustion engine that's been around for over 100 years keeps getting more and more fuel efficient. And small cars are getting safer and more luxurious. Caldwell says while the industry and electric cars catch up, there are plenty of options for those who want to increase the number of miles they get per gallon, even if they're not as exciting. Sonari Glinton, NPR News, Detroit.
You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. When you turn on a light or you power up your radio, where does the electricity come from? Well, there's a good chance it's not coming from whatever power plant is actually closest to your electric outlet, but probably produced somewhere else and distributed over a complicated network to get to you. The famous electric grid, even though there are really many loosely interconnected grids, and the only time you really hear about the grid is what, right? Summertime when it fails, there's a brownout, a blackout, or now we talk about security concerns to the grid. And of course, the grid is not getting any younger, and we're placing more demands on the grid as we need more electricity for things we never had before. You can name them: computers, air conditioners, even the coming generations of plug-in cars. They're all going to demand electricity from that grid. But a recent article in the journal IEEE Spectrum says that our national power grid has been getting less reliable over the years, even as we're going to have to depend more on it. And next week, a major conference on smart grid technology kicks off to talk about engineering a new smart grid that perhaps may even heal itself. It heal itself if before it even breaks down. Joining me now to talk more about it is S. Masoud Amin. He is the director of the Technological Leadership Institute at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. He holds the Honeywell HW Sweat Chair in Technological Leadership and professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Mr. Flatow.
Please, don't get so formal. What do you mean when you say that the system is getting less reliable? How do you put that into numbers?
When we look at the investment in the infrastructure, there are two parts. One is the diminished shock absorbers in the system, in the high voltage grid, as well as the innovation that goes into it. So when we look at the infrastructure, the depreciation amortization curve crossed over investment in the infrastructure in 1995. So we are over harvesting the existing assets, the existing infrastructure, and my hat is off to the grid operators across our nation, across North America, that keep the lights on while operating a system that has less and less shock absorbers.
If the shock absorbers, if they were on your car, you'd know about it. But if, I guess you know about it on the grid because we're seeing more brownouts and blackouts than we used to?
Yes, Ira. On average, actually, when we remove all the natural cause, ice storms, hurricanes, weather disasters from the outages, the most reliable part of our grid is, I'm very fortunate, I live in Minneapolis, is the Midwest ISO. We get about 92 minutes of outages per customer per year. The worst part, the most vulnerable part because of aging infrastructure, is New York and PJM that gets about 214 minutes of outages per customer per year. And on any given day, there are about 500,000 of our citizens without electricity for 2 or more hours per day. This is in contrast to, for example, Japan, that in Japan, using the same metric of removing natural caused disturbances and outages, extreme events, customers experience 4 minutes of outage per customer per year.
So what are they doing better than us?
We take our infrastructure for granted. To share with you a little bit on the investment, I'm not even talking making it smarter. I'm talking about just investment in keeping it strong and robust. Nations such as emerging economies such as New Zealand, but established economies like England, Denmark, Spain, Netherlands, Norway, Poland, they invest between $12 million per gigawatt per year under high voltage, 230 kV and higher. And this is normalized, put on the same level playing field. To give an example, England spends $16.5 million per gigawatt per year under high voltage transmission. All nations that had either partially deregulated or fully deregulated their system, they spend upwards of at least Finland spends about 7 million, is the lowest one. We are below that.
We're below that.
We spend 4.6 million per million dollars per gigawatt per year on our super high voltage, well, 230 kV and higher. In addition, they have number of transmission owning entities in those nations. All of them have one: New Zealand, England, Spain, Netherlands, Norway, Poland, Finland. Denmark has two. We have over 450. And by saying that, whenever I present this, our colleagues ask, so should we nationalize the grid? I said, no, that is not our way of life in America. Instead, we should revitalize the national public-private partnership, since more than 85% of infrastructure is privately owned. We need to build incentives for the different stakeholders to upgrade the system, to look at it as a system, as almost at least major interconnections, and hopefully as we plan for the rest of this century, as a continental scale system, to bring in, to be able to bring in where the energy sources are and use the most efficient carrier of energy, which is electrons, to bring those resources to where the demand for electricity, demand for energy is.
Are you saying we don't need a smart grid then? Or
no, smart grid would make is an overlay. So allow me to briefly say what smart grid is. Smart grid is the overlay, is the sensor network, communication overlay and control devices on top of that system. So there is a part, would you please, to use an analogy, think about skeleton, think
right.
about the musculature, and think about the nervous system.
Right.
Smart grid is the enhancement to the sensors, communication, controls, devices, and systems that operate as an overlay in parallel on top of this hardwired system to enhance reliability, minimize cost, reduce mm-hmm. cost, improve security and resilience, robustness of the system.
It's almost like electronic or an autopilot, I imagine, on an airplane. You're not changing the wings and things, but you're putting a smarter way to control the flight. Because, as you say, those folks on the levers just can't keep up anymore, pushing those levers in those power plants and switching stations around the country.
Ira, well put. Actually, the genesis of this, when I had the privilege of leading R&D beginning about 13 years ago at the Electric Power Research Institute in Palo Alto as the head of mathematics and information sciences there, that's what I did. I used what I had learned working for McDonnell Douglas Boeing Phantom Work and NASA Ames on reconfigurable damage adaptive flight control systems.
Huh.
And the perfect example is an F-15 pilot that an Israeli pilot, Captain Zivi, had landed in 1983 with a missing wing. So this is enhanced avionics, better situational awareness, faster situational awareness to enable better control, better security and resilience to unforeseen events.
Do we need to engineer anything new, or do you know what kind of engineering applications are required, or do we have what we need and it's just not been put into place?
There are both. A lot of it, actually, many colleagues who are many listeners probably are familiar with the smart meter. They think if I have a smart meter, I have a smart grid. But if you step a little bit out, get a bird's eye view, we are actually talking about end-to-end, from fuel source to the end use, from fuel source to your device at home, at work, that is the system. Smart meter is just one node, measurement node, on the customer citizen's interface to the utility. So many of the communication, whether the backbone for the communication is fiber optic or microwave, or locally, whether it's Wi-Fi, WiMAX, security built in, security has to be a critical
right.
part of this so that it enhances security. It should be built in as a design criteria, not sprinkled on as a condiment or glued on as an afterthought.
But how do you get this done? I mean, this is going to cost a lot of money, and we hear about the budgetary problems we're having here.
I will share with you the numbers. Currently, our outages in the United States cost our economy anywhere, depending on the year, anywhere from $80 billion a year to over $180 billion a year. outages, power quality disruptions. The more digital devices we are using, the more demand we are going to need for perfect power. So what's the cost of doing the smart grid? First, the cost of strengthening the backbone of the grid would cost us, and Department of Energy, EPRI, have done the studies as part of transmission study, would cost us about $82 billion to make it stronger.
If that's, you will, that's make 1 year's worth of waste. Is what you're
exactly.
Saying.
Yeah. And it could be spread over 10 years, but it needs that kind of commitment, a 10-year commitment, $8 billion a year, to retrofit and expand this among different stakeholders. So that's stronger. Smarter, to make the overlay, put the overlay of sensors, communication, and control devices would cost us between $165 billion to $170 billion over 10 to 20 years, depending on what time horizon we put in. And the benefits of that, it would reduce outages by $49 billion a year. It would increase efficiency of the grid by over 4.5%, as according to Pacific Northwest National Labs. That would translate into $29.2 billion a year in efficiency, improved efficiency. In addition, it would reduce emissions 12 to 18%.
Wow. So who do you have to convince here to do
you know,
that?
It is clarity using science, using evidence, using engineering to assess these and put everything on the canvas, everything, what works, what doesn't work.
So it's up to someone to take an objective, critical look at this and say, you know, this makes sense. It's worth spending the money on it, is what you're saying.
That's precisely what I've had the privilege of doing for the last 14 years in this area. And the conclusions that I shared with you is a widespread assessment from EPRI, Department of Energy, National Labs, even Brattle Group, that looked at the entire end-to-end system modernization, complete revamp of the entire system. The current system in America, if you don't think of it as North American, then in reality it is North American. The U.S. portion is valued, the whole infrastructure, at about $1 trillion. And this $1 trillion system underpins our $14 trillion economy.
All right. Well, and you're going to be having a conference. The IEEE is going to be having a conference out next week. And we wish you good luck.
Thank you very much. And welcome your participation and your leadership in this area.
Thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Last week, you recall, we took a look at the electronic gadgets coming out of the Consumer Electronics Show. And one of this year's big buzzy things was that talk about the 4G network. Sprint, AT&T, Mobile, Verizon all have 4G now. But what exactly does 4G mean? Because if you peel off that 4G label, they work differently. And in some cases, those technologies aren't even running at the same speeds. But the networks are still advertised as 4G. So what's the difference? And why are even the fastest networks in the U.S. so much slower than networks in places like Sweden and Australia? If the technology is there, why isn't it here? Well, what do you think? Do you have a 4G network already? Let us know. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can tweet us at SciFry, that's at SCIFRI, or go to our website at Science Friday and get in on a conversation there. Chris Ziegler is the senior mobile editor at Engadget in Chicago. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, Ira, how are you?
A lot of 4G at that electronic show, was it not?
Yes. Every American carrier was talking 4G there.
And is there a common definition for what 4G means?
You know, it's interesting. There actually is. There is a technical definition that's controlled by the ITU, which is a body that's run by the UN. And people might be amazed to discover that no current network advertising itself as 4G actually meets those requirements.
No kidding. No.
It's true.
The UN controls the requirements and no one meets it. So what does it mean when they're saying 4G? What are they actually talking about?
Well, what they're referring to, the biggest and most consumer noticeable part of that definition is the fact that they're looking for speeds of 1 gigabit per second down to your device when you're stationary and 100 megabits per second when you're mobile, because it is actually harder to transfer data when you're moving than when you're standing still. So that's what they're looking for. And the only proposed standards that meet that definition are WiMAX 2 and LTE Advanced, and neither of those standards even exist yet in a commercial network.
Well, isn't AT&T supposed to deploy LTE later this year?
They are, but there's a big difference between LTE and LTE Advanced, unfortunately. But yeah, so what AT&T is doing, they have the most confused message of all the American carriers, I believe, because basically what they've done is they've responded to T-Mobile. T-Mobile recently launched what's called HSPA Plus, which is an evolution, a very advanced evolution of 3G that we've had for a few years now, that can go up to 21 megabits and beyond, which easily rivals what you can get in your home with like a broadband connection. So what AT&T did is they said, well, hey, we have HSPA Plus 2. We can't let T-Mobile get away with calling their network 4G, and we're not. So we're going to rebrand that network as 4G, but we're also launching LTE later this year. So we're going to bundle that all into one package.
Is this purposely made to confuse us, all this different technology?
Well, you know, believe it or not, all the executives and marketing folks that I've talked to with these companies insist that they do it to simplify things for consumers, not to complicate things. They don't want to talk about HSPA Plus or LTE because they, you know, they very rightfully say that people don't care, and they don't. That's true. People absolutely don't care. They just want fast data. They don't care how they get it. So they're trying to use these G labels as, you know, an equivalency rating. They just want people to know, hey, this is, you know, this is as fast as Verizon's network, so we're going to call it 4G, just like Verizon.
Mm-hmm. So the basic thing to know is that whatever the new thing is, 4G, whatever technology it is, it will be faster than 3G, better?
That's right. Yes, that's right.
So that's the takeaway message, that if you go in and get a cell phone, that's what you're asking for.
That's right. If you get a 4G device, you will absolutely get a faster data experience. You'll load websites faster. You'll be able to use services like Pandora faster. You'll do all of that. You'll have a cleaner and faster experience with a 4G device regardless of the carrier. And right now, today, all of the carriers will give you roughly the same experience with a 4G network. Over time, that'll evolve, mm-hmm. and you'll see some of these newer technologies like LTE evolve faster and better, and those will get much, much faster. I'm sure that the marketing groups will say, well, you know, maybe you want to call that 4.5G, maybe you want to call that 5G. We'll see what they do. But for now, 4G is 4G is 4G.
Let's talk about another bit of technology babble that came out, something called WiMAX. What is WiMAX? How does that work?
Yes, yeah, so WiMAX is the quote-unquote 4G technology that's in use by Sprint, and they have a few devices available right now that make use of WiMAX. They have the HTC Evo 4G, which they've been advertising very heavily. I'm sure a lot of folks are aware of. But they also have the Epic 4G from Samsung and a couple others. And it's one of the older next-generation data technologies, but it's very robust. The one disadvantage that Sprint has is that they use a very high frequency for transmitting that data. And there's a concept of physics by which the higher you go with frequency, the harder it is for this RF to penetrate buildings.
Right.
So they're operating at 2,500 megahertz, and it's very, very difficult for that signal to penetrate deep inside buildings, whereas Verizon and AT&T for their 4G networks are both using 700 megahertz, which is much lower, and it's easier to get deep inside buildings.
Do you have your favorite recommendations for a 4G network or how you would like to see it work?
Well, you know, what I tell people is that unfortunately, they do need to experiment with all networks. You know, just go into a store and experiment with devices and see which is faster in their market, because it does vary a lot by market. What's fastest in New York might be the slowest in San Francisco and might be, you know, middle of the road in Chicago. You just don't know. Mm-hmm. And it also varies a lot in rural areas, too.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I mentioned earlier in the billboard here, other countries have wireless networks that are much faster than ours.
Yes.
Why is ours so much slower?
Well, there are a couple reasons for that. One is that the U.S. has really, really led the push into high bandwidth, high experience smartphones. Even though countries like Japan and a lot of countries across Europe have been pushing the benefits of smartphones for longer than the U.S. has. Devices like the iPhone have really grown up and taken root first in the U.S., and that has pushed wireless broadband adoption faster than pretty much anything else. So we consume a lot and a lot of data here. And what carriers are struggling with is coming up with enough backhaul, and that's the connection between the cell tower and the internet backbone. They're struggling to come up with enough bandwidth there for these devices, mm-hmm. and they're also struggling to come up with enough spectrum to connect the cell tower to the phone. So mm-hmm. these are the kinds of bottlenecks that we're dealing with here that they're not dealing with as much yet in other countries.
Is it a good thing that we're seeing all these new cell phones coming out, and that, you know, the iPhone was ruling for a while, and now we have Android has taken over in sheer numbers of phones, and now you have iPhone available in Verizon as well as AT&T. This is all good in competition?
It's absolutely good for a couple of reasons. One, I think it's always great when you have a single device that's available across multiple carriers, because that means that you don't have to say, well, you know, I want an iPhone, so that means I have to use AT&T. I have to break my contract with X carrier and go to AT&T. A variety of carriers is always a good thing. But then also, this rapid adoption of high bandwidth smartphones has really pushed the FCC and the trade organization that rounds up all the carriers to get a lot of additional spectrum freed up that we can use for these phones in the future. So the FCC has pushed very hard to free up about a half gigahertz of spectrum, which is a lot of spectrum over the next decade or so, and that's going to help a lot with the bottlenecks we're facing.
It appears that the phone is morphing into more of a digital device rather than a voice device.
Absolutely, yep.
You know.
That's absolutely true. Over the past couple years, we've seen the rapid adoption of full QWERTY keyboards, for example, on phones. And I think that speaks to the fact that people are texting as much or more than they're talking now. And that certainly didn't used to be the case. And of course, these large touch screens make it really easy to use apps and browse the web. And these are all things that, you know, instead of talking to your friends on the phone like you might have 10 years ago, now you just send them a post in Facebook, for example.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we're going to come up with some standard rating for all these various wireless technologies that will really be able to measure each one?
Unfortunately, I don't. I haven't seen any government or trade organizations step up to say, hey, we need to really lock this down. I think that it's going to be up to marketing organizations within all these companies to come up with logical, sensical standards. I don't know if we can trust them to do that, but I have to admit, even though the 4G definition that they're using right now isn't technically accurate, it does do a pretty decent job of showing equivalency across all four of these major U.S. networks.
And what slows down, you talked about different reception in different cities. Is it the physical structures in the city, or is it the density of cell phones? Because I know when I go to a baseball game, when the beginning of the game is no one in the stadium, I have no trouble with my phone. As it fills mm-hmm. up, it's gone.
Yeah. No, I'll give you a perfect example, a famous example. For the past, I think it's 3 years at CES, you know, you have this crush of technology reporters all filtering into Vegas at the same time.
Right.
And by, the middle of day one of the show, your iPhones don't work because, you know, everyone has an iPhone and the AT&T network is just crushed. And to be fair, they do try to do a good job. They have these trucks called cows that are basically portable cell towers that they bring in and station around the grounds to try and alleviate the congestion, but they can only do so much. So you end up having a lot of trouble there. So population density is a factor. And then also, like you mentioned, physical structures. That's a problem,
yeah,
too. In big cities, that's a huge problem.
Are the phone companies spending money on building the 4G network now?
They are. Yes. They're spending billions. And actually, to a point you made earlier, that's another reason why these networks tend to evolve a little slower in the States than they do elsewhere, because you're talking about a $10 billion plus investment per carrier just to roll out these networks because of the size of the country and the amount of data that they need to support here. It's just immense.
Are you do you recommend early adapting or just wait a month, 6 months, things will settle out a little bit more and choices
might be
more clear?
Yeah, I think that 2011 is going to be a real watershed year for these networks, and I think that by the end of this year, we're going to see a lot of really cool things shake out. I'll give you an example. Verizon, as of right now, even though they do technically have 4G LTE launched, They only have the only devices they have for it are two modems that plug into your laptop, and neither one of them works with a Mac. So it's very limited appeal right now, very limited functionality. The devices are big compared to a 3G modem, and those will miniaturize over time. And, of course, we'll see a number of phones start to support it over the course of the year.
All right, Chris Ziegler, thanks for your help.
Thank you.
And Chris Ziegler is senior mobile editor at Engadget in Chicago, telling us how to survive. You know, it's always 6 months. Wait another 6 months for another gadget. We're going to take a break and come back and test your carbon IQ and a new program to map carbon dioxide and methane emissions right back to their sources. We can trace them and find out why after this break. So stay with us.